Hello, everyone, and welcome to End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Mary Lalonde.
And Eliza Crosland.
And I'm very excited to have you guys, very successful independent filmmakers, to talk about a very unusual independent movie. And so I think it's going to be a good show, so thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Well, we can't guarantee that. There's no guarantees. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Thursday at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the buddy comedy based on a true story, The Disaster Artist. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half of the show, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items, like Quentin Tarantino making a Star Trek movie, which sounds kind of weird, but it looks like it may actually happen. And then Casablanca turns 75, and that happened last week, the 75th anniversary of its New York City premiere way back in 1942. And we'll talk about why it remains a classic three quarters of a century later. But first, we must sadly dive back into the ugly, ugly world of Hollywood sex abuse. Sorry to introduce you through that, but it seems inescapable. You know, the specific case that came out this week was, again, for X-Men director Bryan Singer, which has come up before. But since I have two females on the show for once, when this, you know, issue came up, it seems, you know, fated. The one female panelist we regularly have, Candace, is never here when this comes up in the news. So since you guys are here, just your general thoughts and, like, this, like, the Me Too thing and everything that's happened with Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and all these... You know, people, I mean, frankly, luminaries in Hollywood who have been outed as predators and, you know, being women in the filmmaking business, although not to the Harvey Weinstein plateau in terms of attending the Academy Awards, but not yet. But, you know, watching this, how are you guys feeling?
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know what the link is between power and just, you know, why guys can't seem to keep it in their pants. The sense of entitlement that goes with the power. I don't know. I don't understand.
No.
And smarter people than me, I think, are studying the issue. So
the funny thing is I didn't find it surprising either, but I think people were really shocked by the Me Too campaign and how many people came forward.
Right.
You know, and then how many didn't, but still experienced that as well.
And yeah, and there are the people who I think are maybe more tuned in, because I've seen online too people saying like, oh, I can't believe how pervasive this is, and other people saying, well, a lot of people knew, and, you know, you shouldn't be that surprised, and it's, you know, I feel that's maybe a bit unfair. I mean, privilege insulates people like me to a degree, so, you know, you kind of need the dramatic examples to wake you up. The particular case of Bryan Singer, though, I'm surprised it actually took this long to come back up, because these have been allegations that have been revisited before, and of course it also... gets into especially in icky territory involving children.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys think there's, you know, a difference, or do you think that, you know, maybe it's because it's a well-known director? Also, he is gay, and we saw Kevin Spacey try to use that as a defense, and you know, it seems, I don't know. Thoughts. I'm trying to talk my way out of a black hole here.
I think that, again, it's that sort of sense of privilege, and it's a kind of cloistered community. Yeah. And if other people around you are doing it, it kind of gives you license to. I mean, Bryan Singer worked with Kevin Spacey, so I don't know what kind of parties...
Yeah.
They'd go to, you know, that sort of thing. So I think that if other people around you are doing it, it kind of feels like it gives you license. Right. I mean, and to be fair, this has not actually been proven in a court of law yet. The couple of other incidents with Brian Singer were, the charges were withdrawn for...
Thrown out of court, yeah.
For whatever reason. I think they were withdrawn, so I don't know was pressure on the people to withdraw the charges or not. So we'll see what happens with this most recent one.
It's not weird either that, you know, you see several cases, again, especially Weinstein, where they used the law to their benefit. He had NDAs out there. He was settling cases and settling abuse with abuse victims on caveat that they will not talk about it under penalty of being prosecuted under, you know, whatever legal authority an NDA gives you. So you know, I understand the point of view that, you know, it's not nothing's been settled in a court of law, but it almost feels like the law is a suspicious player in this too, if the law can be used to defend abusers as well.
Oh, for sure. And obviously these people have money, more money than the victims do. It's so tricky because anyone could then come out and make allegations against somebody else. I mean, I think it's interesting that if allegations are coming out against somebody and they're not asking it to go to a court of law and they're stepping back, I think then there's a presumption of guilt perhaps there. If you feel that you're being unfairly accused, then the law is perhaps a route you can take.
Right.
I know Al Franken, I was very disappointed with that. those allegations, and he's come out to admit that some were true, but some were, I think in his words, patently false. So, but again, I guess hard to prove in a court of law one way or the other. But I know that the sexual assault cases that do go to court, it's usually in favor of the alleged perpetrator, which is...
Well, they've certainly
can be unfortunate for the victims.
Right. They certainly have advantages because despite, you know, rape shield laws and other protections for victims, the law, you know, as we saw with the Gomeshi case, you know, it doesn't always work the way it should when it's particularly on the aspect of protecting victims.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like a tricky world, too. Sorry, Mary. Just because there's sort of a fine line between when people who are sort of famous and might be able to get you ahead in a career.
Yeah. I think there were a lot of the women with Harvey Weinstein that were kind of during that impulse, like, is this the way the game is played? Because, you know, the casting couch has been a thing.
Probably since ancient Greece.
Probably. In the old plays and, in performances and things. So, you know, that's in the back of your head, too, is... if you're kind of purposefully trying to normalize the behavior because this is what's quote-unquote expected. Mm-hmm. Mary, you were anxious to jump into this conversation.
And I basically was going to say exactly what you just said. So thanks. No, I think the whole idea of a casting couch has been around for a really long time, and it's almost like it comes off as like a rite of passage or something, you know, that, you know, something you have to go through or experience in order to get where you want to be in terms of an acting career.
But again, if it's, I mean, there's so many sort of white males who are in charge of the industry, and if they all think it's okay, then nothing is going to change. So
right.
So it's really good, actually, I think, that all this stuff is coming out and coming to light, and hopefully...
Right.
And I think if we had more women, I mean, not that women are incapable of sexual assault, but perhaps it would help clean up sets a little bit.
Right.
Although, I mean, you know, to be fair, when we're on little indie sets, like, it's a way to kill some of the time is to just, you know, sort of locker room talk. But if someone's not comfortable with that...
Right, you know, it's about, you know, creating an environment.
But that's different than forcing yourself on somebody, you know, as opposed to just, joking around about
There are many subtle levels here, and certainly the things that Brian Singer's being alleged about, you know.
Quite.
That, you know, forcing himself on at parties even. You know, we're not even talking about locker room talk on the set or anything like that. It's, I get that too, having been on sets myself, but there is a way to mitigate that, and I think you're onto something there, that, you know, having more women on set, I think in all male environments, whether that's like the priesthood or whether that's politics or, you know, anything like that, an all male environment, I think, sort of breeds certain kind of behavior when a woman comes into the environment. So the obvious solution is to promote more women, whether that's in the director's chair, the production offices, the executive suites, even the gaffers and the electricians and the carpenters and the photographers and all that. So I think that's probably the long-term solution that could be started in the short term. But yeah, I do think you're right about that. The other flip side of Singer was this whole controversy, and it seems like this kicked it off, was him being fired from Bohemian Rhapsody. I just wanted to touch on that. He's making this biopic about Freddie Mercury, and it sounded like that was, speaking of power and maybe power going to people's heads, that he was getting into it with the star, Rami Malek. He was getting into it with other actors on the set. And then he kind of disappears because he had a grave, a relative who was gravely ill, and then apparently gets fired because he walked and the studio wouldn't give him that time off. So, you know, there's that element on top of it all too, which is...
Yeah, but I mean, who knows what's really going on? I mean, these allegations could have been coming up again, and so many producers are backing away from... I mean, Kevin Spacey's been removed from films that were finished, essentially, and reshot. So
erased.
Yeah. Well, no, was the one that was reshot with...
All the Money in the World.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think producers are trying to nip these issues in the bud.
Well, that's why it's worth noting, because the timing was interesting that he gets fired, and then all of a sudden there's another allegation with somebody with a lawyer. This actually the same lawyer as with the original 2014 allegation. Let's talk about something a bit more, happier, peppier, interesting, intriguing, that has nothing to do with bad people doing bad things, but maybe good people doing interesting things. And there was announced... last week, Quentin Tarantino, of all people, is looking at making a Star Trek movie.
With that lead up, Adam, I thought you were going to be talking about Casablanca, not Quentin Tarantino.
You know, yeah, Quentin, of course, is currently at work on, well, there's no title for it, but it's a movie that's supposed to take place during the Manson murders in 69. Mm-hmm. Although there's some question about whether that's what it's about or just is happening in the background of whatever kooky thing he's working on. But on top of it all, I guess he had a really wicked, awesome idea for a Star Trek movie and called J.J. Abrams and said, hey, you know, did he do the Quintero? Hey, let's get together and do the... I don't do a good Tarantino, but there you go. But I mean, this, if anything else, this seemed to get people talking about Star Trek, which as a Trekkie, I think is a good thing.
Yeah. Now it was under the condition, I believe, that it had to be an R-rated.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which will be the first.
It'll be the first Trek movie that's R-rated.
Yeah.
But yeah, no.
So, yeah, I don't know. I'm a Tarantino fan, so.
But not a Trekkie?
I have seen all the... Oh, I'm old enough, Adam, that, you know, my first crushes were the original William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. So
I used to sit at the top of the stairs and watch behind my dad's back through the railings on the stairs on the original airing of the first.
Because you weren't allowed to go downstairs.
I was too little, six or something.
Oh, okay. That's so weird because I was, you know, it's not that offensive a show. It's not The Sopranos.
It's just too late.
I suppose. They did have it on bizarrely late. the R rating thing is interesting because a lot of people are like, well, can you do an R rated Star Trek? And, you know, I guess, Kevin's the Megatroid. It's an R rated Star Trek. I don't know. It seems to be the trend with these things. If you think about something like Deadpool or Logan, which are X-Men movies but are R-rated and will definitely appeal to the same audience, but, you know, gives them something you don't necessarily get in a you know, the PG-13 flavored X-Men movies. So I wouldn't consider that a deal breaker.
No, but I mean, we won't know until it comes out. So yeah. But I have a feeling that diehard purist Trekkie fans might might not be happy with the direction Mr. Tarantino takes it in.
Well, no, like I consider myself a Star Trek fan, and I actually was a bit disappointed with the last one. I felt story was lacking, and it went more towards action and CG. And I've always loved that about Star Trek, is that the stories were, I thought, really good. And so, you know, I like Tarantino, and I think he's a good storyteller. So I'm hoping it actually gives a little new blood to the series.
Yeah, did you see the new show, Discovery?
Yes, I'm watching it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are you liking it?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Because I liked it, too. And it's, speaking of the hardcore Trekkies, I did notice there was a lot of people immediately were turned off by that because it wasn't what... I think mostly people think about Next Gen when they think about Star Trek on TV, and it's like, well, that show was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It literally 30 years ago. It started 30 years ago. And I like Next Gen too, but it's 2017, and I want to see something a bit different in my Star Trek, being 30 years later. And that's a show that also gets into some adulty things. And, you know, so if it was on... if it was on film in the movie theater, it would probably be R-rated because at one point, I don't know if you've gotten there yet, but the Cadet Tilly uses the F-word.
Oh, no.
Okay, there's an F-word coming up, and then there's maybe, you know, there's definitely more adult themes as you get closer to the mid-season break. The show comes back in January.
Is that a lead-in, Adam, for the fact that Captain Picard would love to come back with if Quentin Tarantino's...
That would be interesting. I'm not sure if Tarantino, though, is a next-gen guy. I think he's an original Star Trek guy. Because I know he's a Trek fan. Because I remember him, he did like one of these like survey things where it's, you know, it's like, do you like A or do you like B? And one of the things he asked was like Star Wars or Star Trek? And he chose Trek. So he's a Trekkie. But I think original recipe track. I'm not sure. You know what? I wouldn't mind seeing Picard come back, or you know, I wouldn't. You know, it's
be still my beating heart.
There is a generation of people who would be.
Well, he was a sex symbol on the show. Oddly enough, even though he was, you know, an older gentleman and bald, but you know, he spoke to some of the ladies in the audience. You know, they dug the Picard maneuver and everything, the tugging on the tunic. But
that sounds like a euphemism.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? He just had class, but you know, it's yeah. So in so much, I don't think Tarantino would bring him back. I don't know if I would love to see him come back, because Nemesis wasn't that great of a movie. That was kind of a weird place to leave that cast, considering everything that the Next Gen had done as a series and how popular it was. So it'd be nice to, you know, have it, you know, in that Patrick Stewart, again, speaking of X-Men, did a nice curtain call in Logan. You know, maybe he can do a nice curtain call on a future Star Trek project. I'm not sure if Tarantino will be it. And of course, it's not 100% Tarantino will direct this either. It's in the, you know, they're batting the ball around stage. He put together a writer's room, which is one of these euphemisms I kind of hate in modern Hollywood, where, you know, we'll do a movie and make a writer's room. but it does include, like, the guy who wrote The Revenant.
Yeah.
And the guy who co-wrote Iron Man 3 with Shane Black. And, you know, so there's some interesting characters involved in this. And I think we'll probably have to wait till 2020. before we start seeing any movement on it, but yeah, I'm intrigued. I wouldn't mind seeing.
And one of the things I'm really liking about Discovery is the strong female characters,
yeah,
roles, and I think Tarantino doesn't shy away from that.
That's
either
right,
so
too.
That would be nice to see in the...
He doesn't shy away from much.
No, it's true.
He has strong female characters sometimes, and sometimes they're just punching bags for the entire film.
That's true too.
So.
Well, you know, maybe Uma Thurman as a Starfleet captain.
I love that.
I think she's doing Broadway right now, so it's, you know, get her back into the movies. But you're right about the Shaniqua Martin Green as Burnham in Discovery. She's so good. I like her a lot. Certainly, she gets more to do on Star Trek than anything she did for like a million years on The Walking Dead. Walking Dead.
Have you talked about it on the show before?
The Walking Dead? Yeah. No, it's not come up. But I mean, I haven't watched The Walking Dead in about, I guess it's been about 2 years. When they introduced the Jeffrey Dean Morgan villain, it was right before he chose the member of the team he was going to bash with his barbed wire covered baseball bat, and they turned it into a cliffhanger. It's like, who's going to die? Come back next year. And it's like, that's enough. that was my perspective on it. It's like, I don't need you to turn gruesome, horrible death into a cliffhanger.
And
thank you, Walking
I think
Dead.
It took most of the first episode of the next season to actually find that out too. So it was
that's
carry that cliffhanger on.
Yeah, that's an aspect of The Walking Dead I do not appreciate. Yeah.
It's one of those things that people kind of love to hate, and one of those shows.
But, you know, it could be that it's coming to it's not coming to the end of its life cycle. I can't believe we're talking about Walking Dead, but but it's, I think that its premiere was lower rated. It was the lowest rated premiere, so maybe people are kind of getting a bit fed up with, let's trudge around the post-apocalypse and evade zombies and fight horrible human beings because, you know, when the world ends, we all turn into jerks. And
yeah, gets me every time, though, there's a zombie attack.
Well, speaking of things that won't die, Casablanca turned 75 last week, and it was released in January of 43, but it premiered in November 26, 1942. And it was, I didn't realize, I knew there were issues with the production, but I didn't realize that they had, you know, made it so quickly. They, the story had, or it was based on an unproduced play, and it arrived out at the script reader's desk at Warner Brothers in like 41, actually December 8th, 1941. And then by that time next year, it was a done movie.
Wow.
So, you know, you think about Hollywood and you think about all this, you know, legions of people working for 2 years through pre-production, production, post-production, release, marketing, and, you know, they get done this thing, which has stood the test of time, and it took less than a year to get it done. But, yeah, it's still, you know, part of the conversation. It's still, you know, quoted, still remembered. What do you guys think of Casablanca?
It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember enjoying it a lot when I did, and I do love old movies and that sort of romantic era. But I really enjoyed it at the time, and I was surprised though reading the article about the anniversary that, you know, how difficult things were on set and how you know they were writing as they were shooting.
Yeah,
and you know, having to pull Bogart off of the director sounded a little bit like what we're going to talk about next.
No, it's interesting because some movies that are sort of a crap storm don't turn out well. But I mean, obviously, I think there was a producer who had a strong vision and was able to sort of pull all those.
Yeah.
Pieces together to create something. There were three writers who all sort of took a turn. Kind of made me think of, I think, Gladiator. That was sort of the same thing that was going on there. There were a bunch of different writers who were pulled off and rewrites right up during shooting, but it still turned out to be a fairly solid story.
Yeah.
So.
And it couldn't have been easy for Ingrid Bergman to act when she didn't know who she was going to end up with in the end. I found that really surprising too. I didn't know that, all these little tidbits that were in the article.
And the extreme unlikelihood she would have ever found herself in the movie to begin with, because she was under contract to another studio, because this was the contract day, and so there was like horse trading to get her to be in the movie. And it's an example of just the alchemy of filmmaking, and I think you guys will appreciate this, how sometimes things just come together, and it's sometimes stuff you can't help. It's just, you know, how things happen, and this is definitely a case of that. And you're right about, you know, there are some movies, you know, Justice League comes to mind, which was a hot mess because you had, you know, They basically remade the movie twice. They had two directors. Mm-hmm. There was rewriting, and certain people became unavailable, and certain people, you know, couldn't come back, and certain people's mustaches had to be CGI'd out. and you know, I think Justice League turned out okay, but you know, just as often, you know, disastrous set can reveal greatness in the finished film as it can reveal atrociousness in the finished film. And sometimes you have such a really smooth process going into the film, and that hides certain calamitous things that are going on that are revealed in the finished film. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's filmmaking's very much an act of faith. And you know, you're right. Yep. The producer you know, clearly had faith in the material and in the stars and the director, and you know, sometimes that gets paid off.
Yeah, and timing to a certain
timing too.
I mean, it was middle of World War II, not the middle for the United States, middle for the rest of the world. So I mean, it was a very timely film that had to get out, I think, during the war for it to be appreciated. And there were certain political events going on.
Yeah,
there was some summit that took place in Casablanca.
Yeah, because they had just invaded Casablanca. Yeah. They just retook it. I think in the weeks. The weeks between the premiere and the release, because I think they were aiming for a summer movie, because then, as now, summer was the time to release movies. Yeah, they push it up because the Allies took Casablanca, so the looming specter of Nazism wasn't there anymore. So
yeah, and I mean, Hollywood was really gearing up, was really a major player for World War II in the States. All the films, propaganda type films that they pumped mm-hmm. out during that time. So
yeah, and a lot of really well known filmmakers behind that. And I'll plug Five Came Back on Netflix that tells that story.
Mm-hmm. I did read about that. I haven't seen it yet though.
Yeah, it's really good. So yeah, I'll plug that, and I will also take this opportunity to plug our musical selection for the week. Vancouver outfit Danny Echo. And this is from one of their albums, their self-titled album, actually. And it is Natural Disaster, and I felt that was a good segue for the movie we're going to review this week, which is The Disaster Artist, and we'll have that after the break. In the meantime, you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. She's a natural disaster. Shock outlaster. Can't believe I actually survived. Natural disaster. Mother to the bastards. Can't believe I actually survived. Swept across the country on the National Express. Underpaid.
Tidal waves. Yeah. Tommy, hey.
Hey.
Who is this?
This is Amber, who I was telling you about.
Oh, girlfriend.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, I don't have time for this. I'm very busy right now. I have to change really quickly and go.
Okay. Is everything all right?
Yeah, everything great on my end. You heard of Konstantin Stanislavski?
Of course. Yeah, he's like the greatest acting teacher of all time.
Yeah. And now he taught me acting teacher. He seemed something special in me, you know, maybe, you know, I'll become a big star. So I have first class this evening.
Well, pretty sure Stanislavski's dead.
No, he's not dead. I just speak to him for your information. What, do you think I speak to, girls?
No.
Okay, I'll let you know how it is, baby face. Maybe you can join me someday.
Maybe I will.
Not so busy.
Yes, he did call him Babyface. That was a scene from The Disaster Artist. It is the new film from James Franco, and it stars James Franco, along with his brother Dave Franco, and Seth Rogen, Alison Brie, Ari Grainer, Zac Efron, Josh Hutcherson, Jackie Weaver, and Nathan Fielder. It is based on the book The Disaster Artist, which is about the making of the so-called Citizen Kane of terrible movies, The Room. So, I think it's, for an occasion such as this in The Room, and you know, people who make films and web series, of course, to have the perspective of people. Because I think who make films, because I think first and foremost, this is an ode to what we were talking about, that spirit of collaboration and filmmaking. And I think that's where this film succeeds, is that it's not about mocking the room. It's about showing the perseverance of, you know, chasing the dream, and how hard it is to chase the dream, and how hard it is to make even a terrible movie. I think that's where it kind of speaks to people, even if they had never seen The Room. Have you guys seen The Room, by the way?
No, but I feel like I've seen enough clips now to justify not seeing the entire show.
I think I might watch it. I haven't seen it, but I might have to.
I haven't seen it in years, but this took me back. So bravo to James Franco. But having said that, how did you guys feel about The Room? Or I guess The Disaster Artist, which is about The Room.
Well... I mean, it's fun. It's fun and it's entertaining. So after watching it, I watched it last night in a cinema. Not pirated version.
Thank you for that.
I try to support other filmmakers. Yeah. It was a lot of fun and I enjoyed it. And I'm not a huge James Franco fan. So I actually found his performance. I'm like... I actually kind of forgot it was James Franco sometimes,
okay, cool.
So I thought he did a good job there. But in retrospect, sort of thinking about it last night and then today, I'm not sure. Like, I think it's kind of fluffy.
Mm.
It's kind of light, L-I-T-E, entertainment. But Mary, what do you think?
Well, I actually just came from seeing it again at the cinema. And so it's still like really fresh right now. And my first reaction when I walked out was it was fascinating and yet slightly painful at the same time.
Why was it painful?
I guess I think one thing for me was just actually the cinematography. I found the handheld like way shakier than what I can normally handle, like at times, which distracted me from the story. But yeah, giving kudos to someone for just picking up crew and saying, I'm going to make a movie and just actually pulling it off is fascinating and a, you know, piece of history, film history.
Yeah, you know, I actually didn't notice the handheld stuff, which may be, you know, symptomatic of getting used to that, because I think that's the fallback when you're talking about based on true material is that people think, well, we got to do it veritas and we got to, you know, do the handheld thing instead of putting it on a frickin' tripod. But I didn't notice that. Different film goers, I guess we are, but I liked it. It is fluffy. I don't see that as a necessarily a negative. I think
think that James Franco was trying to, like, I mean, there's a little bit of potentially Oscar buzz for
sure
his performance, and I think he could have gone a lot deeper and explored it a lot more. It was sort of more like, look, I can imitate this guy really well, you know, as opposed to and the fact that he picked his brother to play Greg. I mean, I don't know. The listeners are familiar with the material,
Sistero,
that the book that it's based.
Yeah, Greg Sistero wrote the book.
Yeah. And I haven't actually read the book, but there are some places in the book that I, apparently, that, you know, Tommy's not the best, nicest person.
Yeah.
Sexism, homophobia. I mean, some potential situations where he might have made
the
wrong impression
with
Greg and other actors and the whole casting couch kind of thing, asking people to reveal parts of themselves and kissing some of the potential actors. You know, there was sort of...
Right.
And then, so for...
The filming of the love scene with the actress who plays Lisa was sanitized.
Oh, no,
yes.
Yes. And it was amusing, right?
It was amusing, yeah.
But with all the stuff that's going on, like, they could have lifted up the carpet and looked a little deeper and gone a little further. And with Dave Franco being cast as, I guess I almost got the sense that it's almost like a bromance isn't the right word, but that sort of, because Tommy Wiseau is an older gentleman, right, and he took this 19-year-old actor under his
proverbial wing.
Yeah. I think that there was potential for some.
Yeah, that it could have been seen the wrong way, and I think that's what the scene with Greg's mother gets at, with Megan Mullally as the mother. It's like, well, why are you interested in my son?
This seems weird. Precisely. And I think so there could have been more, they could have explored more.
Right.
They could have gone deeper. And I know in some of the interviews, James Franco was comparing his film to The Master and Boogie Nights. I'm like, I'm sorry, dude. Like, it was fun, but that was not The Master, you know?
Also, both Paul Thomas Anderson movies.
Yeah.
Paul Thomas Anderson pretty much universally recognized as a master of the craft, so perhaps a bit... I mean, maybe that's a bit of the Wiseau getting in his head, because, of course, you know... Tommy Wiseau will tell you now that making a terrible movie was his plan the whole time.
Yeah.
Making something this, you know, laughable and you know, that gets the audience laughing at it. That's his story. But, I mean, I guess that's maybe a bit of the master at work. But, you know, I will say, no, this is not anything equal to anything PTA has done. But
no.
not by a long shot. But, I mean,
nope.
I do wonder if that is a bit of Wiseau getting into Franco's head a bit.
Maybe. And I'm also just, like, movies about Hollywood. And you know, please. I mean, it happened 20 years ago. Like, I feel like there's a generation of actors who, like, or, you know, because of all the social media and
I will admit
everybody's
that.
Short attention spans,
right.
20 years is about as historical as anybody gets anymore, you know? And it's
I
like,
will admit that. This does feel like maybe it's 7 or 8 years too late.
Mm. Yeah. Too late. Or wait and, or, you know, like, I think of people like John Waters. Or Ed Wood, who made lifelong material bad films, you know, and they earned the one or two that actually were like, oh, kind of that's my kind of a breakthrough, you know. He made one crappy film. We can all make one crappy film.
He has made other stuff
since. Well, he had made that one documentary about homeless people in America or something,
right?
But, yeah, it was not a body of work like John Waters or Ed Wood, you know, people who are really committed. And there was some, there's some gossip that perhaps he was even making the film to launder money. Like, I mean, we don't know where the, you know, so is he an artist?
Right.
Or is he a gangster? Like, you know, I don't know.
Well, that's one of the interesting parts of it. And, To give Seth Rogen his due for a minute, I thought he was really fun as Sandy, who's the script supervisor, because just, I don't know whether it's the Rogen aspect to it or he's actually playing a character, but, you know, just his clinical detachment from everything in the scene where he goes into the bank and he goes, I don't know if this is going to cash. And then the teller says, oh, yeah, no, this guy is flush. And that's kind of like the only outside hint that you sort of get about what Tommy Wiseau is all about.
Yeah.
Although I wonder if it really matters to Franco or anybody involved in the movie about where Tommy Wiseau comes from. I mean, it gets touched upon, but I really felt this was more like Greg's story, and that Tommy Wiseau was kind of like the magical figure who comes into his life and starts him on this journey to you know, being the guy who's known for working with Tommy Wiseau on The Disaster Artist and writing that book and then working on The Room, because that has sort of become both his and Tommy Wiseau's life, is going from midnight screening to midnight screening and promoting the film and talking about the film. And that seems to be his journey in life. So it did feel to, you know, I as interested as I am is where Tommy Wiseau comes from and what his deal is. I have a feeling that was not a preoccupation for Franco at all. And even the way Tommy was always introduced, because it's introduced in this acting class, and you hear the acting teacher goes, okay, who wants to do a scene next? And you hear, I do scene, and it's, you know, it's from behind, and he's sitting in like the furthest, darkest corner of the of the acting class, and he emerges wearing this like Michael Jackson jacket from 1985 and wearing like three too many belts. And so there's definitely like an aspect to Tommy Wiseau that's like of the genie persuasion. Like Greg has rubbed a magic lamp and Tommy Wiseau has appeared and gives him the strength and the opportunity to pursue his acting dream. So
yeah, as a buddy story, I think it was interesting. And you know, the whole James Dean, you know, connection too in there. And I like that part of it.
Of course, there's that connection back to Franco too, because Franco, one of Franco's first big roles was playing James Dean in a movie. Wow. So
yeah.
So they have that in common.
Yeah. Well, I mean, overall, I mean, like I said, it was entertaining, but I don't. I'll be a little saddened and become a little bit more cynical if it has a bit of an Oscar run.
It'll have an Oscar run. It's about movie making.
Yeah.
It'll have an Oscar run.
I'm sad then, and I've become more cynical. Thank you, Adam.
But I mean, this is in the Oscar wheelhouse, of course, and it's got, you know, buzz on it coming out of TIFF and other film festivals. So of course it was going to be an Oscar thing, and you know, we can make an argument about whether, you know, how in love the Oscars are with, you know, filmmakers and filmmaking and fluffy great movies about like the power of filmmaking and all that. But you know, I think there's a bit more nuance here, and there's a scene at the end where they're premiering the film and they're showing, I mean, they kind of do these dramatizations, if you can call them that, of all these classic scenes from The Room, like You're Tearing Me Apart, Lisa, and Oh, Hi, Mark, and all that stuff. The football game in the Tuxes, which kills me every time. But, you know, there's a scene in that where they're showing all the scenes and you're laughing and you're enjoying it, and then it shows Wiseau and Greg in the audience, and they're like, oh my God, we've ruined our lives. And this is, you know, they're laughing at us. And then, I don't know if you guys felt it, but I kind of stopped laughing too. And it's like, oh my God, they're people who are, you know, put a lot of time, effort, energy, and money into doing this thing. And, you know, they're being laughed at. And then Greg comes back to Tommy and says, you know what? People are enjoying it. And then you kind of, it gives you permission to laugh at it again. And then at the end, he gets a standing O. And of course, being Tommy Wiseau, as a, you know, he gets up and takes credit for, I made this really terrible movie for you all to enjoy. So, you know, I get that angle to it. But, you know, I do think there's something a bit deeper in parts.
Cheap deeper. I mean, I get the whole, he's a sympathetic, he is made to be a sympathetic character.
Yeah.
For sure. The whole, the betrayal thing. But again, I think they could have gone deeper with that, you know? I mean, that was a betrayal of friendship? Or, I mean, he felt betrayed when Greg got a girlfriend, you know? Yeah. So I think that there was more there, but that was, it was just sort of glossed over.
Yeah.
And the whole idea that people were making fun of you, which is, of course, I mean, that's universal, you know, that fear. I mean, in high school theater, I was so paranoid that the rest of the theater class was talking about me. As soon as I'd leave, I'd come back. I'm like, I know you're talking about me. Was it just then? But that was high school, right? I mean, right. That was when I was 14 or 15. I mean, this is a grown man. So, I mean, it certainly touches on universal fears and foibles of humanity. But I think it could have gone deeper and further. I guess I would have liked to see that. But you know, if you just want to be entertained, like, it made me laugh for sure. And it, as a filmmaker, it made me laugh when he walked into the rental place and it's like, yeah, no, I'll just buy all the equipment. Well, HD or film? Both. I'll just buy.
And this is not when it was cheap. No.
Which, again, made me wonder if he was just laundering money, right? So
right. Well, that's one of the quirky bits that they don't get into, is that he shot on HD and standard definition film. And then, you know, it's Why not both?
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, as a filmmaker, I was definitely laughing. You know, when it was like day 58 of a 40-day shoot.
That was great. Yeah. I had to do a double take because I know it went longer, but they kept putting up the numbers like day 30 or 40. Yeah. And then it goes to day 52. Of our, I was like, is that what that just said?
Yeah. Well, apparently it took 6 months to actually shoot in the end. Yeah. So.
Again, not an uncommon development with indie film.
Yeah, for sure. It's not an easy endeavor, that's for sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I did want to get that perspective because I find it funny they make a point of it. You know, he builds an alley set that looks exactly like the alley right next to it. It's like, well, why are we building an alley set? It's like, it's a real Hollywood movie, so why wouldn't we?
Yeah, yeah. And all that green screen.
And all the green on the rooftop. Yes, yeah.
I know.
And it looks so obviously like green screen in the room. It looks like a static city shot, you know, behind him. It's why wouldn't you just go to the roof of the building?
Yeah. Although apparently, I don't know if this is true, but apparently he wanted to write in the actual room. He wanted his character be revealed as a vampire flying away in a car. So I could understand maybe wanting the green screen for that, but I guess they all decided that it wasn't going to work. For the amount of money that he had, they couldn't actually succeed. So.
Right. It's not necessarily because it wasn't going to work dramatically. They couldn't figure out how to work in the
vampire. I don't think he cared about that kind of stuff. Yeah, no, it was the technical aspect that wasn't going to work. Yeah, he didn't really seem to have a problem with story holes. Or
no. I loved that scene where they're shooting, where the mother character reveals that she has breast cancer, which is never addressed again in the film. She has this big scene where she reveals to Lisa that she has breast cancer and that nobody can help her. And then it's never approached again. And the actress, Jackie Weaver plays the actress, and she says, like, is there any resolution to this story? And Tommy Wiseau says, no, it's a twist. Yeah. No resolution is a twist. it's funny. It's just funny that that's, you know, you can justify anything, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the green screen, like on the set, it was like, you know, there was chips in the paint and the shadows. And I'm like, oh, really? That's going to work, you know?
Yeah, Mary's a little sensitive about green screen.
Shudder.
You had a bad experience.
Yes. It's hard to edit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's gotten easier, but I haven't attempted it since the first time.
Well, imagine now doing it both HD and film, HD digital and film, and then trying to make sense of all that. I want to shout out some actors. I want to shout out Zac Efron, who played the actor who played Chris R, because I didn't know that was Zac Efron. He was a monster. It was intense. So, you know, way to go, Zac Efron.
Yeah, there were a lot of cameos that I didn't actually realize until I went back through the IMDb list. I'm like, oh, really? Oh, I don't remember. So I'd have to see it again to, like, catch all those cameos. Yeah, lots of little plum. Well, and I thought it was highly amusing, the Bryan Cranston cameo. Yeah. I was like, oh, my God, you're from Malcolm in the Middle. Which, of course, Breaking Bad would be his.
Yeah, that was before Breaking
huge,
Bad.
Yeah, so, right. So.
And speaking of cameos, we should ask people who are going to see the film to stay to the end of the credits, because that's interesting.
Yeah, I missed that, but then I read that it was there. So I asked, I'm like, Mary, apparently Tommy Wiseau's got a cameo at the very end. Again, because he had sort of asserted how he wanted to be in the film, and James Franco was like, no, so we'll do a scene with you, and then we'll put you at the end of the credits. So, what was it? I don't know. How was it?
It was interesting. It was like a rooftop party scene, and it's Tommy, like James Franco as Tommy, talking to Tommy. And then saying that Greg has the weirdest friends.
I think, that may be part of the problem that you're talking about, too, because it's very obvious Tommy Wiseau has a stake in this. Not that he was, like, involved in the actual production anyway, but he's been doing promotion with James Franco. He was at TIFF with Franco.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And I think they were doing interviews together. So, you know, I'm not sure if that was maybe intentional for his participation, because, I mean, there's another drama involving the room full of spoons, which is a documentary that somebody made about the room and the phenomena of the room that's been tied up in court, because Tommy was always trying to, he thinks it's going to mock him and, I guess, degrade the brand, if you will. And that's been going around too. So Tommy was always clearly somebody with an eye on keeping his reputation and making sure that he doesn't get, you know, kind of tarred and feathered, I guess maybe in different hands. There would have been that deeper introspection of where he comes from and what his real intentions were. But, I mean, they're perhaps, in order to get this thing made, they couldn't go that deep.
Right. But I mean, the fact that he insisted on being himself opposite James Franco, who was playing himself in the film,
yeah,
shows that he doesn't really have a full understanding of, well, irony, but also, you know, like, he doesn't understand all the actual facets and tenets of storytelling. So,
right.
And right. You know, it wasn't a sci-fi where you could meet yourself or something, you know, like it was.
Yeah, also can't, you know, that's a time cop rule. You can't have the same matter in the same space. So, anyway.
Yeah. True. I know, but I was fascinated, though, when they played the scenes from the actual room and the disaster artist next to each other.
Yeah. That was fun. It made me think of, because we do one of our episodes in our first season, we have, it's an homage to different films. And so we have our actress doing the orgasm scene from When Harry Met Sally,
mm-hmm.
or doing the orgasm from When Harry Met Sally. And in our behind the scenes, we cut together our actress and Meg Ryan together doing that. So I love watching that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Love seeing how close. Yeah, it's pretty good, though. They obviously watched The Room a lot, those actors, to nail the the similarities.
Right.
And it never came up really to, like, Tommy said at one point that he'd been in a car accident.
Yeah.
And so I was always wondering, like, was he the way he was because of the accident, or was he always like that? You know, that sort of a thing that...
But I don't know if you can really trust anything Tommy Wiseau says.
That's true.
So.
He's from New Orleans, the bayou.
Yeah.
It's
very obviously a bayou accent that he has.
It's interesting. Is he doing like the living the part? Is he, you know, or maybe he really was in a car accident and maybe this is just how he copes? And I don't know. It's so hard to tell. And I guess if you want those questions answered, this is not the movie for you. You know, maybe one of these days we might get that story. Maybe that's in Room Full of Spoons. Maybe that filmmaker found something. You know, who knows? But, you know, I think one of the things I appreciated about Franco's performance is, like, it was not a caricature. It also wasn't like he was going ultra method and sort of channeling Wiseau too. I think there is some balance in terms of he was trying to make Tommy a relatable character or an understandable character, because I think if you were to explain Tommy Wiseau to a person outside of the fact that Tommy Wiseau is a person who is real, I think it's like one of these things we're dealing with, you know, in the Trump adjusted terms era, that, you know, if you were to explain the situation of anything that's going on in the White House right now outside of the context of the fact that it is going on in the White House, people would say, well, you couldn't sell that. That doesn't make any sense. No one would try and do that things. And I think that's the same thing with Tommy Wiseau, that if you obviously they want to reach people who had never seen The Room or maybe never heard of The Room. It's a cult phenomenon. So, you know, he does a really good job of, I think, walking that fine line.
Yeah, he does make him relatable. But again, I you know, again, question, they could have gone deeper, you know, especially with all the allegations about sexual abuse and stuff like that. Like, it made him seem more like a victim.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, than
people telling him he's a villain and he's a Frankenstein.
Yeah.
He was kind of malevolent, benevolent. Character, you know, all wrapped up in one. It was kind of,
it was chaotic neutral.
Yeah,
you
know, interesting. I'm glad I saw it. I'm, you know, I would definitely recommend.
Yeah, the film. And like I said, James Franco did a, you know, I'm just used to sort of his Frat Pack, Judd Apatow stuff. So
who has a cameo?
Yes.
Judd Apatow's account.
Yes. Wait, he was the producer in the restaurant?
In the restaurant.
Yes,
oh, that's right.
So, yeah. Which it was a very, that was a fun role too.
On the receiving end of Tommy Wiseau's recitation of the famous Shakespeare soliloquy, which I think he got three lines in before flubbing that. Anyway, ladies, thank you so much for being a part of the show today, and I'm glad you enjoyed the movie, even if it did not go as deep as some of us would like.
You pointed your finger at me.
I didn't. No fingers pointed. I just let's go back and listen to the last half hour. Anyway, that is it for this week's end credits. We hope you liked it. You'll be able to hear us again on endcreditsradioshow.com. Find us on social media, End Credits Radio on Facebook, End Credits Radio on Twitter. And ladies, maybe if people want to check out Savvy Spinsters or find any of your work online, how can people do that?
YouTube and Savvy Spinster.
Yeah, SavvySpinster.com.
Yep, or our website, MapleSugarFilms.com. The links
right.
are there.
Thanks
so.
For having us on.
Yeah, thank
it was
you.
Fun. It was fun. Thank you. I'm glad we were able to get together, and I hope we can get more of our local filmmakers on the show and talk about other people's movies. Anyway, we're going to talk about politics later today at 5 p.m. on Open Sources Guelph, and I'll be with Scotty Hertz there. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. End Credits will be back next Thursday at 10 a.m., and that will be our Star Wars special, and then we'll have our two year-end holiday specials after that for the next 2 weeks. And that's what's coming up on End Credits, and until next Thursday at 10 a.m., we will see you then.